Hello, Birdfeed. Welcome to a current affairs special bonus podcast episode. Today, in our recurring segment, let's talk about what everyone else is talking about. We're here to talk about the show Tiger King and also tigers more generally and other animals and crazy people and criminal justice and all kinds of other fun stuff. We've got a very exciting panel today. We've got our resident Catalan freedom fighter, newsletter editor Nick Slater.
Hi. Buen dia.
We've got shooter of men into the sun and amusements and managing editor, Lyta Gold.
Hi.
We've got business tanky / friendly neighborhood business manager, Allegra Silcox. Sorry, I almost forgot your last name for a second. Allegra Silcox.
Good morning.
I am finance editor. They didn't come up with a fun thing for my thing. Sparky Abraham.
Money thief.
Special guest today. We have current affairs contributor and also litigation manager at the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals Foundation, Asher Smith. Asher, all the way back like 2 full years ago, wrote an article about how Joe Biden's record on racial integration is indefensible. And then I think you also had one. Hold on. What's your other one? You wrote Tammy Baldwin is great, just not for cows. That was very on brand. Hi, Asher.
Hey, team. Hello, Catalan freedom fighters.
Yeah, are you like a cat freedom fighter? Like Nick's the Catalan freedom fighter and you're the cat freedom fighter?
Yeah, I think that's a good mix.
Okay, so I think we should start just by saying that, like, I'm not sure spoilers even count for the show Tiger King, because it's a little bit crazy. And I don't think that, like, people are necessarily watching for the plot twists, although there are plot twists, but also it's a documentary, so you can just look up what happened. But I expect we will be talking about things that come to light in later episodes, so if you haven't watched and you don't want to hear that, go away now. You know, I don't... Asher, what do you do? Like, what is your connection to this? Why are you here?
I'm here because my day job is strategic impact litigation to further animal rights and animal welfare.
What does that mean?
For example, false advertising litigations against sellers of animal products, as well as citizen suits under laws like the Endangered Species Act. So the reason why I'm here is that for the past couple of years, a lot of my time has been spent on PETA's cases against these roadside zoo operators, and specifically one of the roadside zoo operators, actually now two of the roadside zoo operators shown in Tiger King. Tim Stark, the founder and president of Wildlife in Need in Indiana.
He's the one who asks Doc Antle how he gets his harem. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. That's him. We also, over the past few months, joined Jeff Lowe, the gentleman seen wearing nothing but affliction shirts, as a defendant in this lawsuit after his attempt to build a new roadside zoo with Tim as his business partner fell apart, and he took possession of several of the big cats born at Tim's facility in Indiana. One way or another, this case had also involved most of the folks seen in Tiger King. We subpoenaed Doc Antle for information about big cat trafficking between Tim and Doc. We also deposed both Joe Exotic and Jeff Lowe as part of that litigation. Even before we joined Jeff Lowe, mostly to find out about big cats who moved between Tim's facility in Indiana and Greater Wynwood Animal Park in Oklahoma. You also might have seen one of my colleagues on Tiger King. That was Brittany Pete, who's the director of the PETA Foundation's Captive Animal Law Enforcement Division. And she spearheaded a number of animal rescues from these facilities. Over the past 8 years, PETA's helped rescue as many as 50 big cats, 12 primates, and 73 bears from these kind of facilities. But specifically, PETA's rescued close to 40 tigers and a number of bears, chimpanzees, and baboons from Joe Exotic's roadside zoo.
What do you mean rescued? What does that mean?
Like, how did you go in and free them? Is we facilitated the transfer of these animals from these roadside zoos to reputable sanctuaries. And that's honestly something I'd love to talk more about, because a lot of time in Tiger King was spent comparing the GW Zoo in Oklahoma to Carol Baskin's facility, Big Cat Rescue. But something that more casual viewers of Tiger King might not have picked up on is that Big Cat Rescue is a Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries accredited sanctuary. And that means something pretty important. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get animals to these kinds of reputable sanctuaries, because the mission of these sanctuaries is to provide the animals under their care with safe, fulfilling lives, which means they have to follow strict rules regarding the amount of space they allow these animals' diets, their enrichment plans, their sanitation. They have to meet certain staffing guidelines. They have to meet a bunch of dull, legalistic corporate governance rules. Their mission isn't human entertainment. They're not using animals as photo ops. I was just reading through some of the text messages that we got in discovery and that we published on the public docket in our litigation. And I came across a quote from Jeff Lowe in a text message where he described the roadside zoo he wanted to build with Tim in Oklahoma as a badass place that we could build that would make badass money. And that's not what sanctuaries are.
Cartoon that guy is. Okay, so you like part of the work that you did was basically taking tigers away from Joe and giving them to Carol.
Yeah, or if not Carol specifically, other folks who manage similar facilities with a similar level of accreditation and quality.
Right.
Redistribution of tigers. We're all about that.
The tigers are people, though.
Okay, this is a big question I had while watching. Like, is this Carol actually good? Because I was getting very, very, there's something weird going on vibes. Like, number one,
it could be so difficult to tell because all you heard was the two sides mostly talking about each other with those small interludes from PETA. And the actual conditions the tigers were kept in was not actually super clear between the different facilities.
Well, and the fact that she doesn't pay her workers to me is just a very, very big red flag because she did not seem to be hurting for money at all. Did not seem like the sanctuary itself was hurting for money. And those things just, I don't know, they don't quite add up to me. Obviously, my blind spots are quite large here. So Asher, if they're, like, is she good? Like, I'm sorry to put you on the spot like that, but is she good?
No, that's fine. It would be kind of weird if we were discussing Tiger King and people didn't have questions about Carol Baskin. I mean, it is the case that her sanctuary is accredited by GFAS. I mean, she has to meet a lot of these standards. She has to provide a significant amount of space to her animals. I do think there was a moment in Tiger King that gave a kind of misleading sense of the size of her big cat enclosures. Her staff, I think, is actually a pretty telling point of contrast between what she's doing and what these roadside zoos are doing. I know that Big Cat Rescue has a very involved volunteer and staff education program that's actually used by other facilities, whereas these roadside zoos are, in many cases, literally taking people off the street. Obviously, with regard to Joe's facility, the provenance of the people that work there is even weirder. If any of you are curious, the public docket in PETA's litigation against a roadside zoo in rural Maryland, the case is PETA v. Tri-State Zoological Park, actually includes an expert report she wrote for us in 2018.
Carol wrote for you?
Yeah, that Carol wrote for us, and I worked with her on it. The report was on the costs involved in caring for big cats. And, you know, to your question of, is Carol good? This might be a boring lawyer answer that not everyone will be interested in, but personally, as a lawyer working with an expert, I found her a joy to work with. For anyone who's ever worked with an expert witness before, I think they'll appreciate it. She wrote her own drafts, and, you know, she's an incredibly conscientious person. She really took to her responsibility. She was eagerly reading entire 400-page deposition transcripts before I was even telling her to do so. She tore through all the evidence. There's tons of citations to the record in her report that isn't just, oh, a lawyer dropped it there. No, she read all of this. You know, she takes what she does very seriously and what that means to her and how she differs from the roadside zoo operators is what she's doing is trying to take care of these cats and providing good lives to these cats.
But she isn't paying her volunteers, right? It is as the documentary depicted it, they're not getting paid, right?
I believe that she is a mix of paid and volunteer staff, and that's not uncommon, especially because these are 501c3 nonprofits. They take in a lot of donated labor, not just from the volunteers there every day, but if there's qualified veterinarians who want to volunteer their services, that's something they do. I mean, it costs a ton of money to adequately take care of these big cats. It's not, you know, a fly-by-night thing that you could just do casually.
Like, your answer made sense to me, Asher. When I was watching Tiger King, I kept thinking of Carol as, like, the least bad of a whole bunch of bad options. Because to me, it all seemed kind of like a transparent effort to eliminate her competition. And by having slightly higher standards, she could kind of force everybody else out of the arena, which I guess is, like, it's a relative win for the tigers. Obviously, it would be a hell of a lot better if they weren't caged at all. Obviously, you can't take those tigers and release them into the wild because they wouldn't be able to fend for themselves. And if they interbred with wild tiger species, that would be disastrous. But yeah, it's hard to like see her as a real protagonist, or at least that was my opinion. Like, did anybody else?
Well, but let's talk about the monetization, because I think this is a point that like you could kind of get it if you looked closely at the show, but it wasn't totally clear. Like, they kind of did this equivalency between the amount and way that Carol was making money and the amount and way that like Joe Exotic was making money. But I think like my impression of it was she was charging to come into the park to see the tigers, but she wasn't like letting people interact with cubs and she wasn't breeding and selling tigers, right? Is that all right, Asher?
Yeah. And that's an enormous difference between a GFAS sanctuary and a roadside zoo, is that the focus at a GFAS sanctuary definitely is not any kind of interaction that's not beneficial for the cats in some way. The focus isn't bringing in people to give money and then use the money for something good, but what they're paying money for is to be personally entertained. There's really no way to do what the roadside zoos are doing with cub interaction and be serving the interests of these big cats. And I think that's where there's that disconnect between people who see Tiger King and think that, oh, there's a competition between these sanctuaries and these roadside zoo operators for customers or something. They're really not in the same line of work in any real sense.
How do the roadside zoos break down in terms of like the money that they're getting from just people visiting versus like cub interaction versus actually breeding and selling the cubs?
Yeah, sure. This is something I actually looked up before we spoke. Wildlife in Need in Indiana, which is Tim Stark's facility, used to charge $25 a head for Tiger Baby Playtime events. Those were events that had 30 to 50 people in them. That $25 fee didn't include paying for anything in the gift shop. It didn't include a literal photo opportunity with the big cats where they were positioned on the guest lap for a photo. At its peak, Wildlife in Need reported more than $1.2 million in gross income, and that's reported income. The Indiana Attorney General is currently prosecuting them in a civil suit for misuse of charitable assets. I understand that there's allegations there around the cash that was coming in, whether or not that was reported. I was looking at the text messages we filed in the docket in that case, and I saw this great quote from Tim Stark on this issue where he tells Jeff Lowe, "I could take any place and bring in an easy $4 to $6 million a year, but somewhere like that, if done right, it's an even easier $15 to $20 million per year." So this is a lucrative business, and it's also a business that does operate predominantly in cash.
So one thing that the documentary didn't really make clear is why exactly these like cub meet and greets, this cub petting is so... Carol talks about it a lot in the documentary, that cub petting is really wrong and it's really unethical and it's really cruel. But like, what are the specific reasons? Is it because the cubs are taken away so early? Is it bad for their socialization? Like, what's going on there?
That's a great question. So there's a bunch of different angles to this. And I think the first episode of Tiger King, if your listeners want to remember back to that, there's this really vivid graphic they put on the screen that showed the life cycle of a big cat bred for the cub petting industry. It's like a timeline, and it shows that after being taken from their mother within hours or minutes of birth, there's only about 10 weeks there in which they have what the chart refers to as economic value to these roadside zoos. That's from about 6 weeks old to 16 weeks old. Then the rest of their life, they're a financial liability. And when they age out of these photo opportunity events, they're simply discarded. They go to other roadside zoos. GW Zoo with more than 200 tigers is kind of a warehouse for these animals. They go to private backyards and basements. There are also numerous allegations that came up in the documentary that more unscrupulous roadside zoos kill these big cats. So the whole industry is a big source of overpopulation and violence to these cats. But maternal separation also inflicts a lot of direct injuries on these cats. It's not a one-time trauma. It's that when you take a nursing cub from their mother, first of all, they won't get the nutrition they need. They won't grow properly, but also they won't learn behaviors that they need as adults. They won't be fully operational big cats. What you have is a situation where they're taken from their mother. Their mother will usually care for them for up to 2 years, and they're thrown into these stressful public interactions. There's a lot of jarring visuals. There's a lot of sound. They're being constantly manhandled. It's really bad for their health all around. And as they're exhausted, they're more prone to becoming sick, to catching viruses, to catching diseases. There's really nothing about maternal separation that is good or neutral for these cats. It really harms them in a number of chronic and serious ways.
It was really heartbreaking to see when they actually pulled one of the cubs right after birth out from underneath that fence. It's just started to cry a little bit.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because, like, one of the recurring images throughout the whole miniseries is, you know, Joe Exotic or, you know, insert Zookeeper X, cuddling up to the cats and saying how much they love them so much and how much, you know, they just love their big fuzzy buddies. And it's really hard to square those thoughts of loving cats, but also just, you know, ripping them from their mothers on a, you know, I guess like monthly basis, maybe.
I think that's a theme with all the personalities. So we're talking, you know, we asked the question, is Carol good? But then we talked about, you know, standards for keeping animals. And I think they're probably two different questions, how animals should be cared for and whether or not the people involved in the documentary are good people. But you can definitely see a theme that people who seem to be the worst offenders caring for or not the tigers are also the worst offenders for how they treat human beings. So I feel like it's the same kind of concept that a lot of people would say, Doc Antle will say that he loves the women that he's with and at the zoo, but you can clearly see that this, you know, harem is not in the best interest of the women who are involved. So it's really telling of whatever kind of pathology these people have that they can claim to love something and be the best thing for those things, but actually they just suck, man.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. I mean, these people are criminals, just to take what was seen in the documentary. Trafficking in endangered or threatened animals like big cats is a felony. Abusing federally protected big cats is a felony, but it's not just these animal crimes. In 2008, Jeff Lowe pled guilty to felony mail fraud for posing as a charity to get markdown products for a liquidation store he was running.
Oops.
For the longest time, he had an active warrant out for his arrest for a wildlife violation in Las Vegas. There's an owner of a roadside zoo, PETA, recently won a lawsuit against in Dade City, Florida, who was arrested last year for fraudulently soliciting charitable funds. Her son, who was also the zoo's president at one point, pled guilty in 2016 for two counts of misdemeanor sexual misconduct after exposing his genitals to minors. So these aren't good people.
Classy.
So I think the reason people watch and enjoy Tiger King largely is because these people are fucking crazy, right? Like, they're extremely eccentric in a lot of ways that seem like harmful to cats and people, but are also kind of fun and interesting to watch. Is this the eccentric group of roadside zoo assholes, or are all the roadside zoo assholes crazy as hell?
Are some of them non-assholes even? I mean, I can't imagine that would be the case, but
I think the thing to keep in mind is that keeping animals in these conditions is itself incredibly violent. Like, there's not a better way to run a roadside zoo like this. It kind of intrinsically involves a great deal of violence, whether it's because there's a lot of animals that, for lack of a better way to describe it, are to these people financial dead weight. Your listeners might remember that the federal indictment against Joe Exotic included five counts of shooting and killing big cats. Tim Stark actually once killed a leopard with a baseball bat. I recently attended a court hearing in Indiana for the Indiana Attorney General's prosecution of Tim, where a witness testified that at one public interaction, Tim threw, kicked, and stomped a baby tiger just because the baby tiger nipped Tim while the baby was teething. You know, this is kind of par for the course at these facilities. Normal people don't run roadside zoos. I'd say there's different places on the continuum of delusion, where there's people who really misguidedly think they love these animals, but are just inflicting tremendous harm on them through extreme mistreatment. But then you have the other end of the spectrum, where you have people like this who are inflicting knowing physical violence. I mean, I think it was kind of played for jokes on Tiger King, but that fire at Joe Exotic's facility didn't just destroy his recording studio, it also killed multiple animals. For whatever reason, I don't quite know why, fires at these facilities seem extremely common. There was a fire at Wildlife in Indiana a few years back that actually killed 41 animals. These kinds of really horrific examples of violence are really just endemic to it, no matter who's doing it and where.
There seemed to be kind of like a common thread throughout all of these roadside zoo operators. And to me, it was like people who couldn't separate admiration from desire.
Ooh, getting deep.
And it was interesting when they went back and looked at like the origin stories of Joe and Carol in particular. You know, as young people, they were just enamored with tigers and big cats, which I think is something that's pretty relatable to all of us. Like, big cats are just really fucking cool. They have big claws and they can jump in interesting ways, and they're fast, and they're just interesting animals. But most of us don't take our admiration and translate that into a need to own these things for like our personal pleasure. You know, like, we can separate our admiration from the cats from a desire to possess them. And I guess in some people, those wires don't connect. And so you end up with people who, you know, claim to love tigers who end up inflicting the most horrific suffering upon them. And yeah, that does seem to be like a common thread for all of these people.
Yeah, I think the possession aspect is really spot on. I mean, these people tend to be hoarders. They have more animals than they could take care of. They often have many hundreds of animals. They have shoestring staffs of people who not only aren't paid at all, but also might barely be at the facility. They're often doing things mostly by themselves. And there's just a tremendous amount of neglect that goes into it. I was looking at those text messages again, and I saw one between a volunteer at Wildlife in Need and Tim Stark, where the volunteer said, hey, Tim, the smallest spotted skunk is dead. Tim, did they have food? Volunteer. Nope. So, I mean, that's just the kind of stuff that happens when you have, say, 300 animals and maybe five people responsible for caring for them.
But can we talk a little bit about the spectrum here? Like, this is clearly a very extreme end, but one of the reasons this made me so uncomfortable to watch was not just the obvious horrific conditions, but was thinking about how often I think most of society does let other kinds of probably not great things slide. Like, as an example, where are we on the sliding scale? Because I know a lot of people go to breeders to buy dogs and cats and things, and I've heard many things, very ignorant about a lot of these topics, but in general, I feel like just this practice of breeding a specific type, I know there's lots of harm caused to certain types of like strict inbreeding. And I mean, another very different example would be, does anyone know how many dogs police shoot a year? It seems like there's a lot of different kinds of harm to animals in general that society just overall accepts. But because this is such an extreme example, we can all gawk at it, say how terrible it is, and not really have to question the more mundane, common types that we encounter.
Mm, tigers are the most charismatic of the charismatic megafauna.
Yeah.
Asher, do you work on puppy mill stuff?
You know, Peanut's always interested in pursuing cases against pretty much anyone who's doing harmful things to animals and using animals for human ends. I mean, we're always open to ideas about how to pursue bad actors in this space. If you know anyone, for example, who you think might have a viable claim that has to do with the breeding of dogs to meet these really horrific breed standards, feel free to get in touch with me or any of my colleagues.
What does that mean? What would someone who like has a viable claim about dog breeding be?
I mean, it's really interesting because, I mean, there's consumer protection law. There's a lot of law around product liability. Obviously, what's the product here? Who's the end user of a dog bred by a breeder? Also, these dogs are bred to satisfy breed standards set by these third-party organizations who aren't part of the transaction at all. So there's clearly a lot of law yet to be made here. So to answer your question, who could have a viable claim here? It's really a question of, well, let's see. If anyone, say, adopted a dog that ended up having breed-specific health issues that they weren't expecting, that would be someone who might have a claim. What claim would that be? Well, let's find out.
I have a lot of questions.
Ask them all.
So, like, at the end of Tiger King, Joe does, like, a turn. Right? He like does a pivot and seems like he's now informing PETA somehow. What's the deal with that?
Yeah. And part of that process is that as things were kind of spiraling out of control for him, he did turn to PETA and ask PETA to help move a lot of his animals from his facility to good sanctuaries. And, you know, PETA is not going to let grudges stand in the way of saving actual animals that exist. So PETA did that. PETA was able to move a lot of his animals, including big cats, to GFAS accredited sanctuaries. As Brittany mentioned in the documentary, PETA also visited Joe in prison and you know, asked him questions about this industry and how it works. He certainly told us a lot of things about the other players in this world. I think that if you remember from that last episode of Tiger King, they kind of mention a lot of those things. I know that one that came up are these persistent rumors that Doc Antle is simply euthanizing tigers that age out of these cub interactions. Is that all happening? Well, there's a lot of smoke here. We'll have to keep investigating to figure out if there's fire.
So this is some crazy shit to me. It's like the lack of record keeping requirements, or maybe they're requirements, but they're just not enforced. Like, it seems to me like it shouldn't be that hard to figure out, okay, you had X number of tiger cubs, you sold Y, and now you have Z. Right? Like,
but isn't selling them illegal?
Or you transfer them or whatever. Yeah, maybe selling them is illegal, but it shouldn't be hard to figure out. Like, if you have a park, like, somebody should know how many tigers there are there. Right?
Like, there's not that many tigers in total.
Are they cooking the tiger books?
No. They're juking the stats. They're juking the tiger stats.
It depends how often you set fire to your facility and burn up all your
records. Right. That's true.
I mean, the answer to that question is really yes. Every federally licensed facility, and the license is under a law called the Animal Welfare Act. It's an exhibitor's license. Has to keep disposition records as to what happened to all of its big cats. But I mean, I've seen firsthand examples of roadside zoo operators who treat that requirement with contempt. There is an incident at Tim Stark's facility where two cubs were declawed. The surgery was botched and they were suffering from really severe infections.
No.
And the USDA visited his facility and he was attempting to hide these animals. He didn't have them on the record that he initially showed them. And he eventually had to admit that he didn't include them on the records because, in his mind, if he wasn't going to show the cats, if the cats weren't going to stay at his facility to be displayed, he didn't have to include them. Now, I can assure you that's not the law, but law enforcement in this area is incredibly uneven and sadly getting worse. Since 2016, the number of legal citations the USDA issued to the around 10,000 facilities that it inspects have been decreasing precipitously. I think something horrifying like 65%. The Washington Post had an investigation where they were told by USDA officials that they're being told to emphasize education over enforcement. For example, instead of citing a legal violation, to do something called a teachable moment. The real upshot of this stuff is that when you try to teach instead of cite, it doesn't create a public record that groups like PETA or other animal rights groups can use to realize what facility they should be targeting, who has to be held accountable for what. Until a very recent change to federal law, and by recent I mean literally the middle of 2019, the Trump administration had halted the practice of posting any USDA inspection reports online publicly, which meant that the only way to get these things was FOIA. So we couldn't even track the reduced amount of legal oversight that was taking place.
And that's the Freedom of Information Act, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Just for all the non-lawyers listening.
Yeah, we had to get this through the Freedom of Information Act instead of the old way, which thankfully is now the current way again of pulling these from the internet. I mean, that's also why, to toot their own horn a bit, groups like PETA and other animal rights organizations are so important here, because the laws like the Endangered Species Act that allow us to act as private attorney general for at least some of these species allow us to sue, and they allow us to get discovery about these places, and they also allow us to get new court decisions on the books that then serve notice on other roadside zoo operators that if they have incredibly deplorable conditions of confinement, that violates the Endangered Species Act and they can be subject to criminal sanctions, that if they do things like declaw big cats, that can violate the law. We have a preliminary injunction against that in one of our cases right now. We also have a preliminary injunction that enjoins maternal separation as a likely violation of the Endangered Species Act, and these public interaction sessions themselves. So even though the federal government in enforcing the Animal Welfare Act might not have the will or ability to put a stop to this, at some point our hope would be that there's indisputable legal precedent that holds that, no, you can't separate a big cat cub from its mother. That's an obvious violation of the Endangered Species Act.
It's interesting that there's such a strong libertarian streak with so many of these roadside zoo owners that we see in the documentary. And yet, as you're pointing out, like, the laws themselves are not really being forced, and they're relatively, you know, there's a ton of stuff that hasn't been legislated that really needs to. So I guess the overall impression that we're sort of left with, and the documentary, one of the things I think the documentary does well is that it suggests things rather than, like, having a strong editorial stance. You know, it's, I don't know, you could argue at some points it's to its detriment, but I think it's actually nice to just express things the way they are. But what we see from a lot of these people is that they are sort of petty tyrants. And what they essentially want, and what they're so mad at the USDA about, et cetera, is they want absolute control over their little kingdoms.
And their harems and cults.
Yeah. So cool.
Yeah, like the Tiger King, like the title alone, it's not just cute. You know, like these people are actually carving out fiefdoms in which they do. I mean, look, they have their own armed forces, you know, a bunch of arm-toting guards patrolling the premises. They have, I guess, like, not their own currency, but sort of like internal circular economies.
Walmart expired meat, you know, is like the, you know, feeding your peasants with that.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like, but the workers and the cats, and then also the customers.
Yes. Everybody eating that expired meat.
The dumpster meat. Like,
an interesting thing about the lack of reporting that came across my mind while watching was, like, so you'd imagine that it's like people on the ground who have to, like, report infractions because, like, the USDA isn't just going to, like, get a bat signal, you know, and then, like, send out a helicopter or something to investigate. You figure, like, most of those initial warnings would come from local law enforcement. Local law enforcement also seems like the exact type of motherfuckers who would be lining up to, like, hold two cubs at a time and, like, you know...
These are the people who, you know, can't solve the murder of Carol Baskin's husband. So, incidentally, she was in the right. She was just a mistake. She was correct. That was the right thing to do.
I missed that whole thing. I zoned out. I was following a lot of the early parts of how they met and everything. And then, like, that episode was over. And I was just like, wait, I feel like there's a lot of information about their actual, like, late-stage marriage that I missed. So I can't really comment on that piece. But
so, Leda, is All Men Into the Meat Grinder the new All Men Into the Sun? Yeah. Like a more low-cost alternative?
To be fair, her meat grinder... too small for a body. Carol Baskin.
I don't understand why this is the only thing. There's so many ways to get rid of a body, I think, based off of a couple of mafia movies I have seen.
Well, and, you know, person who has quite a few carnivorous tigers probably has some good ways of getting rid of
it. Oh, but the pigs do better.
The pigs, you know what? All I'm saying is I think she was justified. He seems like he was a shitty dude. You get that money, Carol.
Wait, are we really just gonna let that slide without a defense?
Of what?
What's the defense?
Well, I mean, in general, just saying somebody deserved it, within, like, backing up the claim for me, who apparently fell asleep for like 20 minutes of this episode, would be great.
Like, you could make a strong argument that everybody involved in this series needs to be eaten by tigers, or getting eaten by tigers would be justifiable.
I'm gonna stay in the nobody deserves any of this camp, but
you're sweet.
Well, but actually, so this is a good segue, I think, to another kind of interesting part of this, right? Is, like, Asher, when you're talking about this, I mean, I don't think you might not be on the same page as, like, I am about this, but basically, like, what you're talking about revolves around a lot of, like, criminal law enforcement, which I kind of want to be skeptical of, but also seems like the way this is structured is kind of the only way that a lot of action happens in this space, right? Like, how do you account for this? Like, can you be a prison abolitionist and also have things that you can do in order to protect animals?
Yeah, I think so. And that gets to kind of the buzzword of the day for my organization, which is speciesism, which is that a lot of the idea that we would want law enforcement involved here has to do with the fact that you shouldn't be able to inflict these harms on animals, that it doesn't make sense that you can starve an animal to death, that you can shoot a tiger, that you can sell a tiger, that you can do these things without facing some kind of criminal sanction, just like you would if you were doing that to a human being.
But law enforcement does, like, cage and starve and shoot human beings.
I mean, people shouldn't shoot and starve each other. I would hope that we'd have a criminal justice system that's able to focus on things like that instead of criminalizing people who don't deserve it.
I guess, is there a way to do this without putting roadside zoo owners in jail is my question.
Like citizens posse groups or something?
Well, I don't know. Like
vigilantes? I'm in favor of it.
This is another part of the thing, right? It's like, does Joe really have a come to Jesus moment at the end? You know, the documentary kind of gives it, the show kind of gives it this, like, this flavor where it's like, oh, you know, as soon as Joe like goes to PETA, then it's like showing the videos from him at the very beginning of his thing where he's like talking about how he would never breed cubs and like how he wants to be a sanctuary and like he cares about the cats and whatever. And it kind of gives it this redemptive quality, which I don't necessarily know that we should trust because it's like a nice story arc, but it doesn't seem necessarily to exist in evidence.
No, that guy will do anything to be famous. Like, I was thinking jokingly, if we can't put Joe Exotic in prison, what do? You put him on like the Game of Thrones Walk of Shame. He'd probably love it. Like, to him, that's just ratings. What's the difference if they're yelling shame or we love you? So literally, what could you do besides preventing him from physically doing something? And right now, the way that we do that is prison, which sucks.
Well, maybe just take away his tigers.
But then how do you prevent him from buying
more
tigers?
The other thing you can do that's not criminal sanctions is you have animal rights organizations that are willing to serve as private prosecutors here and use these citizen suit provisions to hold these people accountable and set precedents. I mean, the outcome of my litigations against these roadside zoos isn't, unfortunately, to my mind, full disclosure, that these people would face criminal sanctions. It would be that we get a court order saying that we can transport these animals to good sanctuaries. And we get a court order that says that these people are enjoined from owning, acquiring, or possessing any more endangered or threatened animal.
One of the craziest things, I think, in the show was like, when they were talking to that dude, was his name Mario or something? The guy in Florida who was also a drug dealer. And he was like, oh yeah, when I was 18, like I just bought a lion. And some of what you're talking about is like, are you saying that you have to have a license only to show the animals? Like, can I just go like drop a few $1,000 legally or illegally and like buy a tiger? And is there any way that we could just prevent that from happening?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, with the enormous caveat that it is illegal to buy that animal if that animal is federally protected. Yeah, if you have an animal that you say is your animal companion, you're not showing them or exhibiting them, the USDA is essentially powerless. And if that sounds like an enormous loophole, well, it is an enormous loophole. There's no shortage of times, for example, when PETA will see on social media that an exhibitor is proudly sharing photos of themselves doing something really stupid with an exotic animal. And when they're called on it, their first line of defense is, oh, this animal is a personal pet, or this animal actually belongs to my wife and it's her pet. Sadly, it sometimes works.
Can we just have a thing where, like, you don't own animals? My dog's just my friend, I think.
Yeah, I do think that there is absolutely no reason why anyone should be taking care of an animal that they're not qualified to. I mean, there's no reason why a person should have an exotic animal. And this really extends beyond the charismatic megafauna. You know, it might be ubiquitous in a pet store, but the fact is that all those reptiles and snakes you might see in a store are themselves also exotic animals. And sadly, almost no one actually is qualified to take care of them. If you're actually looking to the numbers, and a bunch of folks have tried to do this, it's estimated that something like 75% of the reptiles and snakes that are bought in pet stores die within the first year. I mean, there's really no reason why people should be possessing animals they can't provide a maximally fulfilling life for.
So is that kind of the distinction that's easiest or most commonly used? Because I struggle with that. Where is the line that gets drawn? And that was an interesting statistic that I didn't know. It's just, look at how often people do successfully care for a certain type of animal. And if it's not a good number, then we just say no.
Yeah, or like, what's exotic? Like, you said that those, like, reptiles are exotic, but like, what, I assume dogs are not exotic.
Like, is a bearded dragon exotic?
Oh, yeah, I do think that most people, if they have the means and the time and the interest to figure out how to do it in the right way, can give a dog or a cat, just like two very obvious examples, a life that's really wonderful, that includes a lot of natural flourishing, that's mutually beneficial and will make their dog or cat very happy. And I don't know exactly where that line is, but I think it's definitely the case that pretty much no one could provide that kind of life in their apartment or home to a tiger. Sadly, it's certainly the case that almost no one can do that for a lot of animals that are sold in conventional big box stores as well.
So when will we get around to talking about the obvious point, which is whether or not Jasmine from Aladdin should have had a tiger? Yes. Because to be fair, she has a whole palace. She has a lot of resources that most people don't.
She did have a whole palace.
That's the biggest estate, I think.
Yeah.
But it was an inside tiger, which seems pretty cruel.
Well, but there was a lot of gardens. It's a very inside-outside kind of palace.
We didn't see how many, like, tiger doors there were. Little flaps.
Look, as long as the tiger wasn't declawed, like, Asha, when you mentioned earlier that the tiger cubs were declawed, like, that was just a horrifying thing. And, to full disclosure, when I was growing up, I had a cat who was declawed. Like, my parents got us a cat. They got the kids a cat. And they said, this is the normal thing that you do when you get a cat so they don't destroy your furniture. And it wasn't until much later when I got cats of my own where I was like, oh, that's not just like cutting their toenails. That's really bad. Could you explain a little bit more of like why that's actually so fucked up?
Yeah. So, and sadly, the narrative here is about the same actually for exotic big cats as it is for your standard house cat. The anatomy is really the same. It's just the difference in size and scale. When you declaw any feline, what you're doing is you're not trimming nails, you're amputating bone. So what you're doing is you're cutting that last knuckle, and then for the rest of that cat's life, they have to walk on that amputated knuckle. So it's not just the risk that this surgery will go poorly, that the cat may have a bone shard permanently in its paw that's always hurting him or her, that the surgery spot can become infected. It's also the fact that any cat, be that cat a tiger, a lion, or a house cat, is going to have his or her behavior permanently changed by this procedure. She won't be able to walk normally. She could easily have trouble doing things like standing or really any activity that places weight on her paws, jumping, sitting. That cat also is going to suffer from a number of behavioral issues because claws are a cat's first line of defense, if anyone who's had a cat in their home can attest. And that cat won't have its first means of defending itself from the outside world. So that cat might develop a number of behavioral abnormalities as well.
My shameful admission is I have two cats. I have one who is declawed and one who is not. I fully blame my ex-husband. I will take no responsibility for my declawed cat. But I remember growing up, I also had... You know, my mother grew up in a time where her county didn't have like an SPCA that I knew. They had a humane society that her father volunteered for. And at times they had like dozens of cats and dogs and a monkey once and just crazy stuff. So I just trusted her advice and ideas about how to take care of animals implicitly. And this was back before they had the laser surgery. And I was just so, so upset when my little tiny kitten came home in this like bloody blanket and seemed so upset. And, you know, they're not allowed to use the regular cat litter because it'll get into their wounds. So you have to use the special, like, recycled newspaper litter. But the cat still found a bucket of sand somehow in the garage. It was just, like, so traumatizing. And I didn't want to declaw my cat when we got him at all. But I was really young. And my ex-husband made these persuasive arguments about, you know, they have the laser surgery now and the recovery is easier. And if we have a kid, we can't risk a cat clawing the baby. And I'm always sad now. I mean, my cat seems to be a happy little kitty, but I'm always really regretful, and I feel so bad when my two cats fight because one of them has the claws and the other one doesn't. That's just not fair. I wonder how we can get that message out, because I still know a lot of people who don't understand that it's an amputation.
Well, that's actually a really interesting point. So one of the common criticisms about Tiger King is that it doesn't focus enough on the tigers themselves. There have been articles in a number of different outlets. The one that I'm thinking of off the top of my head comes from The Independent, and there's a line in there, and it says, Tiger King isn't the series that PETA would have made, but it has captured the world's attention and shown a light on the exploitation of big cats in captivity. And I'm sorry, Asher, I want to separate PETA's legal work from PETA's marketing work here. I think that it's good as hell that this isn't a film that PETA would have made, because I think it's way more effective. You know, and one of I think, Lyta, you hinted at it earlier, one of the strengths of Tiger King is that it leaves a lot to the imagination. And so you end up actually doing more thinking about the issues that are being discussed and if it had all been kind of spoon-fed to you. And the UK director for PETA had actually said in this article that they've seen a surge of interest in their exposés of the captive tiger industry. industry. And so I think that it's actually sometimes more effective to give people like a little taste as opposed to like the full like flood of information, because the little bit that you see is bad enough. You know, your imagination goes places, imagining what other kinds of abuse are happening, which hopefully is a motivation to take a firm stand against it.
Oh, I'm really worried that's not true. I mean, maybe Asher, you can talk about this, but like also a lot of things that you see as a result. So like, A, I think that probably if Tiger King had actually shown more of the tigers, it probably would have been much, much less popular because it would be too depressing for people to watch, right? People just like don't want to see that. And I guess I'm like, I'm worried because a lot of the reaction that I've seen is people who are like, free Joe Exotic, right? Fuck Carol Baskin. And I'm curious to see, I mean, it's impossible to tell now because like we're all in pandemic land, but I'm curious to see if like this will actually cause more people to go visit roadside zoos.
You know, Wynnewood, Oklahoma has a sign that says home of Joe Exotic. My dad lives in Norman, Oklahoma and works in Wynnewood. And I said, I don't know that I would be advertising that.
Yeah, like what? I mean, do we know how this is going to... I guess we probably don't know how it's going to play out yet, but that would be my concern.
They smeared a whole lot of stink on the concept of roadside zoos. Like, it's really hard to watch, like, a Doc or Joe or... I mean, I'm sorry, even Carol. It's really hard to watch any of these people and think, like, oh, man, I would love to spend more time around them in an environment they designed. Like,
I don't know, man. You might be overestimating people.
Curiosity is such a powerful force. I mean, I saw a video knowing virtually nothing about any of this. I had seen some video circulate about, I think it was Jeff, and when I realized, oh my god, he's in Wynnewood, and I'm sitting here thinking, I don't know anything about this. I had no idea how to evaluate the difference between some kind of a sanctuary that's best case scenario for animals that had lived in captivity versus what we're now calling roadside zoos. And this part of me was like, maybe next time I'm in Oklahoma, I'll just go like look at the kitties and see. But when I got there, I Googled it and was like, no, this doesn't seem good at all. I'm not going to go. But if I hadn't Googled it, and even after I Googled it, I still don't know. I still have a hard time telling. I don't want to go to any zoos anymore because I don't know how to really tell if they're the quote unquote good kind or bad kind. And I have a difficult time even trusting accreditations because then I have to go research the organization that accredited and figure out if they're just a bunch of assholes. So it's...
If I'm in a hotel room in Vegas and somebody brings in a baby tiger, like, it doesn't matter how much I know it's wrong, I'm going to pet that baby tiger because it's so cute. And that's a huge problem because, like, one of the issues... And so in general, I think that the documentary did a good job of showing people's point of view rather than editorializing, but they didn't show... And I think they should have shown more of the actual abuse and contextualize that a little better. They didn't contextualize cub petting and why it's so bad. Because the problem is, looking at these big, gorgeous kitties, you want to pet them. And it's really like huge instinctive impulse. Like, you get it. You want to be around them and you want to look at them. And it's bad because it does make you want to go. It does make you want to go to these places and see them and pet the baby cubs.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you really hit on it there is that there's no way to have these kind of interactive experiences with cubs and not be at the very least supporting the separation of cubs from their mothers. That's really the first thing that has to happen to have a cub be on public display. It's essentially impossible for that not to have happened and have this experience. I do think it is the case, pivoting back to the documentary, that the information is there. I think it does require a certain amount of familiarity with what's being shown, or at least paying really close attention to everything on the screen. But there is the information there that I think teaches people a lot about roadside zoos that they didn't know before. I mean, a couple of you mentioned this, but something that's really hard for people, I hear when people call human beings consumers as if that's who they are at the moment, but it's really a hard consumption choice too for people that these places pass themselves off as sanctuaries. Pretty much all of them, actually. If you go to their website, they might even have conservation messages on there, and it's really impossible as a member of the public. I mean, I think if you do some investigating into a facility, if you know, oh, this is nearby and I want to learn more about it, there's things you could learn to look for. For example, you could look for that GFAS accreditation. You could look to see if their social media and if their website is supporting things that I think people now realize are obviously bad practices. I mean, a good facility won't be propagandizing for public interactions with these animals. So I think it has increased a lot of awareness here, where before people might have taken those kind of false advertising messages at face value. And now I think people are better armed to investigate not just the facilities that they consider visiting, but if they're on Reddit, if they're sharing something on Instagram or Facebook or to Twitter, to not share that cute baby animal photo because that looks like it comes from a public exhibition.
Can I continue my role of ignorant participant for a second and say...
Why is that your role?
I'm not a lawyer. I have no like training in any of these things. But so I am the role of average viewer of Tiger King, and I'm sitting here thinking, horrifying. I'm thinking Carol Baskin doesn't come off great because of things that Nick's already mentioned. So I'm looking up whether or not she's actually that different. So I Google the big cat rescue, and I find mostly results from PETA and regarding this accreditation. And I don't really see that many other sources. And if I'm somebody who maybe isn't super sympathetic to PETA or has maybe heard criticisms of PETA around a variety of ways, that's really difficult for me. I mean, my solution, I've already said, is to just not go to any of these anymore and to just watch dodo videos on YouTube. But I think that is very difficult because accreditation, I think we're using as a shorthand for quality care. And it is a little bit difficult to dig in and find sort of what could be seen as close to an impartial source that really lists the actual why is it better. I thought that was very difficult for me. I didn't really leave my brief search with a better understanding. So what can people who might be skeptical of PETA or other like animal rights organizations do to potentially conduct their own research?
I mean, honestly, I think that your instinct of not going to try to have these kind of in-person experiences at these facilities is the right one. I mean,
but if Big Cat Rescue doesn't have any visitors, do they have enough money to care for their animals?
I mean, there are a number of GFAS accredited sanctuaries that simply don't have any kind of public access or public tours, or, you know, you can't buy a ticket and go to them. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that's a good instinct because it's just obviously the case that animals aren't ours to use, you know. It's not like, oh, we're going to do this good thing for this animal, so now it's okay that we use this animal for our entertainment in this one minor way, or it might seem minor to us. No, we just shouldn't use animals for entertainment. I mean, I think what makes a sanctuary good and what people should look for is whether or not that sanctuary is using animals in any way that's explicitly or obviously for entertainment. And if they are, then it's not a good facility.
Yeah, that makes sense. I have one last question about accreditation, because in the documentary, I don't remember if it was Joe or Doc Antle who were sort of poo-pooing the idea that Carol Baskin's facility was any better, and they were talking about this accreditation, and it sort of implied they couldn't even get these people on the phone. They sort of were implying we could be accredited too, but they won't give us the time of day. Do you know anything about that or what the process is like for accreditation?
Yeah, I do know a bit about that. And it's the fact that, you know, it's not like you submit an application in the mail, you twiddle your thumbs for 10 months, and then you might get dinged. Like, these organizations, I'm speaking to GFAS specifically, because that's what I know about, and they're really the best ones in this field, that they work with facilities to try to get them to the level of GFAS accreditation. There's levels of GFAS accreditation, and there's also a back and forth process where there are a lot of people out there who want to do good by these animals, and they want that seal of approval for their work, because reasonably so, they don't want to be lumped in with the Joe Exotics of the world. And it very much is a process of working with these places to get them to the point where they can be accredited. It's not just, oh, you're not good enough, goodbye. Now, for someone with Joe Exotics history, where you have someone who notoriously abused animals and is had animals die in fires, rumored to, and now convicted of shooting animals. It's kind of a different thing. But for someone who's working in good faith, who runs a sanctuary and doesn't want to be lumped in with these roadside zoos, I do know that GFAS tries to get these facilities to the right place. It's not a all or nothing one shot deal.
Like, are there other factors?
So my suspicion was he just didn't call.
It sounds like they're just full of shit, right? Any suggestion that they could have been accredited is bullshit because of the practices that they have that everyone fucking knows about.
Well, that's the point. Like, are there other factors that we could look at? Like, say, not to judge anybody's lifestyles, but if you're a polygamist with, you know, 7 underage or almost underage spouses, concubines, whatever, probably we should steer clear of your sanctuary / refuge / whatever you're calling it.
Yeah, but at the same time, if I was thinking about like going to a grocery store or a movie theater or some other random kind of facility, my first instinct isn't to Google the owner and figure out if they were convicted of any crimes. And I just think a lot of people haven't developed this instinct that animal-based facilities are more likely to be that way, right? When I was a kid, I just went to a zoo. It never occurred to me that going any kind of a zoo would be really bad. And now I'm suspicious of virtually any zoo and any place that lets people go in to gawk at animals ever since someone told me about SeaWorld.
Can we talk for a minute about Doc Antle?
He's
fucking the tigers, right?
I feel like the documentary kind of, you know, like it went in on him a little bit, but I feel like there must be more there.
Main focus of the story, I think, was the problem, because there's like definitely a lot.
I love the moment where he's like, you're going to say it's a cult. It was very like, oh, like my claim that I'm not a cult leader is raising a lot of questions that are answered by my claim that I'm not a cult leader. Right?
This got like 5 seconds worth of airtime in the series. But so his origin story, the way that he gets his name, you know, Bhagavan Lord, was from his time at Yogaville, which is an ashram in Virginia. It was founded by a guy named Swami Satchidananda, who, if you know him at all, you know him because he's the guy who gave the address at Woodstock, the sort of peace and love Indian guru who welcomed everybody into the good vibes. Also a notorious, notorious center of abuse and weird sex stuff and like many other just very, very deeply weird things. So considering that's where he came from, like the fact that he's like just fucking tigers, probably, allegedly, maybe, like not that much of a shock at all.
Asher, do you have, so I guess like from your perspective, I could see this going two ways, right? Which is like you deal with a bunch of lawyers and like you kind of have a sense of all this weird shit, but a lot of the stuff in the documentary was a surprise to you is one way, or maybe like you know a ton more weird shit than was even shown in the show. And I don't know if you could like talk about any of that, but like, how does that work for you?
Yeah, I definitely know a ton more weird stuff that was not shown in the documentary. Wow. I think that they really just scratched the surface there. And I think it goes in both the malevolent and the sad direction. Like, I think, for example, they didn't really have the bandwidth to go into the criminal histories of all these guys. The fact that if you're running a crappy roadside zoo, then maybe you also exposed your genitals in public to people who didn't want you to, or you'd run some kind of charity fraud. Again, the amount of horrifying violence that happens to these animals and just how gruesome being in these roadside zoo conditions is really hard to convey in any documentary that's not many hours, but I don't think it necessarily came across. I mean, one example that always sticks in my head, and this is part of our litigation against that rural Maryland roadside zoo, and when we sued them, they had 9 federally protected animals. At the end of our litigation, they had 5, because 4 of them had died during the litigation. And I don't want to, you know, do a sob story for each one, but there was one lemur that I always think about. His name is Bandit, and he died after a lifetime of chronic respiratory and neurological issues that were brought on by years of psychological trauma in inadequate habitats. And when he died, he was hypothermic, and he had literally torn off his own penis. I mean, the details of what happens to these animals, not on an exceptional basis, but really on an everyday basis, is really something. I mean, just going through the discovery we get in the roadside zoo litigation, there'll be big cats that just drop dead from eating gravel in their enclosures because, again, what do these people know about the proper substrate for a big cat enclosure? There'll be animals that just face really disgusting physical violence. The amount of violence that gets inflicted on people, too, at Wildlife in Need in Indiana, one of their contractors was mauled by a hyena last summer. There's publicly available photos from when the Indiana Department of Natural Resources investigated, and that individual testified in a public hearing about a month ago about this. There have been many, many bites and scratches at these public interactions. You know, I think that people see what goes on and they think, oh, wow, it's a miracle that no one got hurt. And the actual truth is, oh, no, people are getting hurt all the time.
I'm kind of interested in like the human cost of these places too, because it does seem like just abuse all the way down.
I mean, that's why Doc Antle was one of the more disturbing ones to me, because there was a little bit less focus on him. And I just found the grooming system that he had to be just truly horrifying, because I think that you can watch that documentary and say, oh, well, yeah, like those cockroaches in the trailers, obviously the people who work at GW Zoo are being treated really poorly. And I worry that there's some people like that other roadside zoo owner who was so impressed with Doc Antle's harem, who were just like, oh, well, he's not doing anything wrong. And to me, it's deeply, deeply wrong and very cultish and just super scary.
Yeah, and I think the stories for the kind of people who end up volunteering at these facilities is really interesting. I mean, I interview these people all the time. I speak with them as part of my day job, and it really runs the gamut. I mean, I've spoken with people who went to volunteer at these facilities, and their story is they were there for 1 or 2 days. Their reaction was, holy shit, and then they left because they couldn't believe what was going on. Or they were there for 3 weeks. They were doing really menial tasks. Then the first day they were allowed to see what was going on with the animal care part of the whole deal, they ran away. I mean, it really is something. I mean, I was at the license revocation proceeding, the USDA proceeding against Tim Stark, and one of the USDA inspectors testified that Tim told her about a conversation he had with a volunteer, where the volunteer was shocked at the amount of animal death that they were seeing on a day-to-day basis. And Tim was like laughing at this deluded volunteer in his mind, being like, oh, you have exotic animals, that's just going to happen. And the USDA inspector's commentary to that was, no, that's not what's supposed to happen. I mean, these volunteers often are people who love animals, they want to be around animals, and for whatever reason, they have an investigator, they haven't been able to investigate what the truth is behind the facility they're volunteering at. And they get caught up in this, and they get a lot of brutal injuries and damage inflicted on them. I mean, something that comes up all the time in speaking to these people was something that Allegra was just mentioning, of they're told to cover up their injuries. It's very normal for me to hear from a volunteer that, oh, this person was bitten by an exotic animal, and she was pressured to pass it off as a chainsaw accident.
Sounds like a hell of a bite.
One of the things that really struck me about the documentary that I think it did well, I mean, it was clearly an animal rights issue, but it's also a labor rights issue. And one of the things that was touching and sad and terrible about Joe Exotic's workers, who were very, very loyal, it seemed, most of them at least were very, very loyal, is that very often they came from, they had nowhere else to go. These were people right off the street, often just out of jail, and really had nowhere else to go. And yeah, he was offering them like $100 a week and expired Walmart meat, but that was better than zero. So no wonder his staff felt extremely loyal.
Yeah.
You know, and felt that there was no choice but to return to work. It was very, very important to see these two things in parallel, the abuse of animals and the abuse of people at the same time.
I think we've been on for a while, and I think we need to wrap it up here at some point.
Could we take a couple minutes and just talk about like our favorite parts of the series? Because like we were very like, you know, issues focused and pragmatic and responsible. But like there was just some fun, goofy shit that I wanted to mention. Like, what are the biggest like mind fucks? Aside from all the personal drama, aside from all like the polygamous marriages and murders and whatnot, was seeing just like the fucking alpha moves that the director made throughout this series. Like what I heard, Down in the Hole, which if you're not familiar with that song, it's the Wire theme song. Like to use the Wire theme song in a different thing is just, it's a huge fucking alpha move. At a later point, James Gattison, who was the FBI informant, kind of big dude with the Prince Valiant haircut who owned the strip clubs, and he's riding the jet skis through the sea with like the dramatic like,
what was with that scene?
What the fuck was that?
That was Eastbound and Down. Like that was totally
that was Eastbound and Down.
Stealing valor and just like, I'm sorry, but the fucking guts to pull off both of those moves in one series, like, I don't know, respect. That's all
You're
I got.
You're right, that was Eastbound and Down.
I couldn't place it. That makes sense.
Asher, do you know anything about that guy? That guy seemed like he sucked, but also was like kind of being portrayed as a good dude, but I...
That guy sucked.
I did not...
Sucked. Strip club owners always...
No, that guy's like, a rapist. You can tell.
I know that I was trying to be a bit generous earlier by describing the volunteers at these places as sometimes people who really love animals and just made a mistake, but I think that anyone who stayed at Joe Exotic's facility through the things they saw, through things like animals dying in fires, through five big cats being shot in the head, there's really no redemptive story for them.
I don't accept that, but that's okay. There's a redemptive story for everyone. They just haven't gotten there yet.
I did find myself, it's one of the things I like best about it, being feeling a great deal of sympathy for Joe Exotic, even though he has done some many, many, many terrible things. Because, you know, he's a big, messy, gay drama queen living his life in this extremely, you know, in the South, in these extremely, like, weird conditions. And yeah, again, he does very awful things, but his, like, his sheer flamboyance, like when he's running for governor and he's, like, standing there with a draped in the lights. I mean, that's, there's something kind of wonderful about that. And again, back on the issue of prison, I don't think he deserves to be in prison because I don't think most people should be. And he also has contracted COVID, which in prison, so which is something to keep in mind.
But is this both, like, the... I mean, this is like a good and also dangerous aspect of the show and of doing it this way, right? Because like that also gives you the possibility of like focusing on sort of the redemptive qualities of Joe and completely ignoring all the bad shit.
I thought it actually did a very, for all the character, all the people, that it portrayed them as complex, flawed, often monstrous people, but not without degrees of sympathy. Like you get Joe's backstory, you get that he... You know, he was kicked out by his parents. You know, you also get that he obviously preyed on these much younger and straight men and made them his husbands and controlled them with drugs, which is really, really fucked up. But yeah, you can see that there's like this deep like well of need and lack in him and in a lot of these. And then they're trying to fill it with tons of tigers and it's not working. Yeah, no, these are, and I think some of the objections I've seen to the series are that there isn't an easy protagonist. There isn't an easy hero. I think people wanted Carol Baskin to be the hero, and she's, you know, she's made better than them, but, you know, killed her husband. So that's a thing. But it's the real life human beings are complicated. And I think it's important for people to, like, look at a guy who's in jail and be like, real people are complicated.
I do have to say, to the point that there's no hero in this story, I have to speak up for my colleague Brittany.
Oh, that's fair.
Who recurs numerous times in the documentary and is just explaining all that she does and that PETA does to save these animals and how PETA has been rescuing these animals. I mean, Brittany is the hero of Tiger King, and I'm sorry that I haven't seen that pointed out in more places.
Yeah, I mean, because I don't think that was framed that way for people to think of that. It was more just like an expert testimony, but you're totally right. I mean, I think it's very important to have sympathy, because I think the ability to experience really pity for somebody who does something really terrible helps with the things that Lyta's talking about, instead of, because I just don't think anyone's really helped by a torch and pitchfork type of mentality, which we tend to have if you only list out the terrible things someone's done. But at the same time, I'm not really going to spend any tears on like Joe or Doc Antle, but I do have a lot of tears for the volunteers. I mean, if we think about how they're preyed upon, it's gross, and I don't know how I'd hang out with somebody who was sort of complicit in a lot of those things. But to me, it's just so much easier to turn my rage and censure on a system that allowed that to happen. You know, to Lyta's point, why were some of these people still at Joe Exotics? Because they didn't really have anywhere else to go, because a system in society that made them destitute, put them in prison, which then made them probably very incapable of finding another job. You know, that's the thing that I'm really angry about when I watch those movies, but it's harder because I can't snap my fingers and fix those things, and it's easier to snap your fingers and put someone in jail. That wasn't my favorite part of the show. I don't know what my favorite part was, Nick. I'm sorry.
I liked how Doc Antle kept trying to direct, and the director showed him trying to direct.
Yeah, you're right. That was my favorite part.
That was like the first thing you saw of him was that he was trying to direct. And you're like, I know everything I need to know about this guy right now.
I hate him so much. He makes my skin crawl. I hate it.
Yeah, he's the only... him and Jeff Lowe, I'd say, are the irredeemable characters in the show.
I was going to say, I do want to challenge you for saying that this really shows the complexity of everyone. Identify for me the complexity in Jeff Lowe's affliction shirt and search for a hot nap.
Oh, okay. Jeff.
Whoopsed Among Us has not wanted a hot nanny.
And I'm so glad they kept that little bit because it tells you so much about him. Jeff Lowe's the kind of person who you saw him keep betraying people and like keep, he's like, I don't know why everybody I work with starts to hate me. You know, and it just continually, all of his business partners hate him. You know, complexity doesn't mean that people are like an equal mix of good or evil or that they even have any good. Complexity just means that you're seeing, you get to see who they think they are and who they actually are. And one of the things that we thought was really interesting is that every person they interviewed had pretty good insight into other people and like zero insight into themselves, which was really kind of fascinating to watch. And like Jeff Lowe was just like, I don't know. But you know, watching why nobody likes him, it's because he's a terrible, terrible person. You find out that he violently beat his first wife. You know, he's a real shitty guy.
Jeff might know. The other people I thought were definitely self-deluded. Jeff might not be self-deluded.
He might. It's hard to say. I mean, definitely seemed sociopathic.
Like he and Doc were more clearly purposefully manipulative. But I think for me, what the big difference is the complexity. The more that you see a pattern of behavior for somebody, the more that I start to identify it as a pathology. Like, I can't look at Joe Exotic and not say, like, there is something wired in him that does not know how to process or act in a different way. And that brings pity to me. I think about, why are they that way? It doesn't necessarily change how much I hate what they're doing. But again, it's easier for me to put away the torch and pitchfork mentality and say, like, we need to fix the system so these people stop getting created. Because I don't think that, I mean, somebody more qualified than me can talk them down from what they're doing. But a lot of us just think, oh, you're just doing a shitty thing right now. I think there's more agency behind it. If you have a pathology, it kind of robs you of a little bit of your agency for how you behave. So I don't know. That's what is interesting to me, but I still hate their stupid guts.
Yeah, it is definitely a show about trauma, like in every possible way. Okay, cool. Well, on that happy note, this was fun. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Thanks, Asher. We really appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we can talk about other things at some point, too.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, signing off, I guess. I'm Sparky Abraham. Goodbye. We've had Light of Gold.
Bye.
Nick Slater.
Goodbye, friends.
Allegra Silcox.
I'll be just one.
And I am going to out that Oren has been lurking around here the whole time. We don't want to talk on the episode. But send
internet
us some messages that inform some of our questions. Yeah, internet heartthrob, Oren Nimby, legal editor. Okay, adios.